Srila Prabhupada wrote spoke a lovely commentary on this song. This song was sung by Narottam Das Thakur, a great devotee and acharya in the Gaudiya Vaishnav Sampradaya, the disciplic succession coming down from Lord Chaitanya. Narottam Das Thakur has written many songs which are recognized as authority by all Vaishnavas. He has sung these songs in simple Bengali language, but the purport, the deep meaning of his songs, is very significant. In this song he says, Goranga bolite habe pulaka sarira. One has attained the perfection of chanting when as soon as he chants the name of Lord Goranga, who initiated this Sankirtan movement, at once there is shivering in his body. This is not to be imitated, but Narottam Das Thakur is asking, when will that opportune moment come to us when there will be shivering of the body as soon as we chant Lord Gauranga's name? After the shivering, Hari Hari Bolite Nayane Babe Nira, while chanting Hare Krishna, there will be tears in the eyes. Then he says, Arakabe Nitai Chand Karuna Hoibe. We are all asking about the mercy of Lord Nityananda. Nityananda is supposed to be the original spiritual master. So we have to approach Gauranga, Lord Chaitanya, through the mercy of Lord Nityananda. What is the symptom of a person who has achieved the causeless mercy of Lord Nityananda? Narottam Das Thakur says that the symptom of one who has actually received the causeless mercy of Lord Nityananda is that he has no more material desire. Arakave nitai chandera karuna hoive samsara vasana mor kave tucha habe. Samsara vasana means desire for material enjoyment. And Narottam Das wonders when it will become very insignificant. Of course, as long as we have bodies, we have to accept so many material things, but not in the spirit of enjoyment, only to keep body and soul together. Narottam Das says further, Rupa Raghunatha Pade Hoibe Akuti. When shall I be very much eager to study the books left by the six Goswamis? Akuti means eagerness. Because Rupa Goswami is the father of devotional service, he has written a book called Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, in which there are nice directions on devotional service. These topics are also dealt with in Chaitanya Charitamrita and other books, and we have given the summary of those directions in our book, Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. One has to learn of the conjugal loving affairs of Radha Krishna through the teachings of these six Goswamis. Narottam Das Thakur directs us not to try to understand the conjugal love of Radha Krishna by our own endeavor. We should try to understand this yugala piriti, conjugal love, under the direction of the Goswamis. As long as the mind is too much absorbed in the materialistic thought, one cannot enter into the kingdom of Vrindavan. But Narottam Das says, Vishaya chadiya kabe sudha have mana kabe hama herabo Sri Vrindavana. When the mind is completely purified, being freed from material anxieties and desires, then I shall be able to understand Vrindavan and the conjugal love of Radha and Krishna, and then my spiritual life will be successful. Jai Srila Prabhupada. Well, in this song that we just sang, Srila Prabhupada, or Narottam Das, mentions twice Rupa, the name Rupa, Rupa Raghunath, two of the six Goswamis, whom Srila Prabhupada in his explanation, he simply says the six Goswamis. So I thought we'd take as our starting point this verse on the board, which was composed by Rupa Goswami. And I've just heard that, I've just been told that this verse is inscribed on the wall in the Bindu Madhava temple in Prayag. And the reason Prayag is the confluence of the, close to the confluence of the Ganga and the Yamuna, right. It's a very sacred place in India. So one day, Lord Chaitanya was in Prayag, and while he was there, it just happened that Rupa Goswami and his brother Anupam, they had been traveling from Bengal, and they were looking for Lord Chaitanya. And in those days, of course, you know, you never actually knew exactly where someone would be at, on the external level. But in the absence of modern communications, I think they had their own much more subtle ways of communicating. And so I'm sure it wasn't an accident that they just happened to reach Prayag at the same time as Lord Chaitanya was there. So they met Lord Chaitanya and Rupa, and it was a very special meeting because they had met before once when Rupa was... He was very talented, precocious. At a very early age, he rose to great prominence and he became the personal secretary of the king of Bengal, Nawab Hussein Shah, who, by all accounts, was a cruel and warlike man. But somehow, he had Rupa Goswami as his personal secretary. Sometimes it happens that, you know, people who are raised to great prominence in the world, they have a brutal side, but they also have another side to them. He must have had another side to him, that he wanted the company of someone like Rupa as his private secretary. And he also, of course, Rupa's brother, Sanatan, was his prime minister. So he was attached, clearly, to these two, both of them young men from high caste Brahmin families, and he took them into his service, which meant that by accepting that offer, you know, they lost their caste in the eyes of the high caste Brahmins. They lost their caste, which has to be significant in the great story, you know, of the unfolding of Lord Chaitanya's teachings, because many of the people who were closest to him were not really part of mainstream Hindu society. You know, Lord Nityananda was an avadut, which I don't know really what it means, but it means he didn't belong in any particular, he'd completely abandoned any sort of social standing at all. An avaduta. Somebody who doesn't belong anymore in society. And he doesn't, you know, sometimes you say a sannyasi has no position in society, but he wasn't a sannyasi, he wasn't anything, he was an avaduta. And Namacharya Haridas Thakur, as we chant every day, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur, whom Lord Chaitanya made the teacher of the holy name, he also was, you know, he had no caste, he was from a Muslim family. Anyhow, Rupa, traveling with his brother Anupam, reached Prayag. And he had met Lord Chaitanya before, yes. When Lord Chaitanya was traveling, you know, from an early age in his life, when he was known as Visrambar. And he had a sort of a conversion experience. I'm talking about Lord Chaitanya now. When he was a young man, at the age of something like 18, his father died, and he went to Gaya to offer prayers for his deceased father. That was the custom. And something very extraordinary happened to him in Gaya. It took him a month or so to get there, walking from Navadvip, his home where he grew up. And he went with two or three friends. They were students, actually, because he used to teach as a young man. That was his profession. He was a teacher. And he taught Sanskrit and logic, Sanskrit grammar and logic, that was the custom. You know, you learned rhetoric, logic, grammar, same things they taught in Oxford when they started Oxford University, actually. And he was an expert, particularly in Sanskrit grammar, so he could defeat anyone. Even when he was very young, he used to take pleasure. People knew him as Nimai Pandit, and he used to take pleasure in challenging people. For a sport, he would challenge anyone to a debate. And he would completely defeat them, totally. To the point where some of them would even cry, because he was so sharp. And then having defeated them, sometimes he would then say, okay, he would change his proposition, and he would take their argument, and then he would defeat it himself. So I don't know, somewhere or other, he swapped sides. And whatever side he was on, he won. And lots of people got upset with him for this, but they could not bring themselves to dislike him, because he was so, charismatic wouldn't really describe it. He was so effulgent. The descriptions of Nimai Pandit are that his personal beauty was just overwhelming. Recently I've been writing a book about Lord Chaitanya, which is due out later this year. And my editor was upset with me because I kept saying how beautiful he was. And he said, you know, and he's from New York. He said, enough with the beauty already, you know, something like that. He wanted me to tone it down. So I tried my best, but I couldn't, in all honesty, because that was part of the story, that Lord Chaitanya was his personal presence was so overwhelming for people that just by his presence alone, you know, they loved him. So his father died, and it was necessary for him to go to Gaya, a pilgrimage. Wonderful custom, you know, when your father dies or some dear relative, you go on a pilgrimage, and particularly in that part of the country, it was to Gaya. And he took with him two or three of his students. So when he got there, there's a big temple. I've not been privileged to go, but there's a large, ancient temple in Gaya. I'm not speaking of Bodh Gaya, which is the holy place connected with the Buddhist religion, which is nearby. But Gaya itself is a huge temple of Vishnu. And in the heart of the temple, I'm told, is a black stone. Perhaps is anyone here who's been to that temple and seen it? The black stone in the heart of the Gaya temple. There's a black stone, and implanted in the stone is the footprint of Vishnu. Then there's a story, which I don't know about, he slayed a demon. And this footprint is there in the stone, you know, this size. And this is the ultimate objective of any pilgrim to Gaya, is to see the footprint. And it's in a small inner chamber, you know, though the temple is big, like some of these traditional temples of ancient India. The temple is huge, but when you actually get in, after going through successive sort of entrances, and gradually you reach the innermost, it's called the Garbha Griha, is it called? The womb chamber. They call it the womb chamber of the temple. And there, in the sort of half light, illuminated by, no sunlight enters there, but illuminated by lamps, burning ghee lamps, and attended by pujaris, very sort of attentive pujaris who won't let you, you know, misbehave or anything, very protecting this sacred place. There is the footprint. So when Nimai Pandit, as he was known then, when he entered and he saw the footprint, suddenly he was completely overwhelmed. He burst into tears, he began to cry, his whole body began to tremble and shake uncontrollably, and he fell on the ground and almost lost consciousness. And his friends who were with him couldn't understand what was going on. But they managed to pick him up and carry him out, or help him out of the temple. And when he re-emerged out into the sunlight, the first person he met was Ishwarapuri. Now, Ishwarapuri, a very significant person for us, because he was a disciple of Madhavendrapuri. Madhavendrapuri is renowned because he had a deep, deep devotion for Radha Krishna. And Madhurya Leela, the mood of conjugal love for Krishna, was something that he had at a time when it was not widely known. And he was an ecstatic devotee of Radha Krishna. His disciple Ishwarapuri had once visited Navadvip, and while he was there, he was hosted by Lord Chaitanya's father, Jagannath Mishra. Sorry. He was hosted by Jagannath Mishra. And he was a very, you know, himself a very gentle, loving Vaishnava. And Nimai Pandit, he was only young at the time, but he got attached to Ishwarapuri. So, as he emerged out of the shadows in Gaya, he suddenly found himself face to face with Ishwarapuri. At a time, and he was completely bewildered and overwhelmed. You know, he just had this extraordinary experience. And so he must have been in something like a trance. And suddenly there he is face to face with Ishwarapuri. How wonderful, you know, life is, that just at the right moment, when I'm ready, they say, don't they, when the student is ready, the master will appear. So he fell at his feet and begged his shelter. And Ishwarapuri understood immediately the situation. He said, come and see me tomorrow. Because he wasn't, you know, Nimai Pandit wasn't really in a condition to have a conversation, we can imagine. So the next day, he went to see Ishwarapuri, and Ishwarapuri initiated him with the Krishna mantra, which in fact is a line that we say in the Gayatri. That's the mantra he initiated him with. Krishnaya Krishna. Krishnaya Govindaya Gopi Janabhavaya Namaha. That's the mantra. That's the mantra he initiated him with. So he began to chant that later that day, after having received Ishwara Puri and fed him and so on. He went on his own. Lord Chaitanya went on his own, Nimai Pandit, and he started to chant on his own in a secluded place. And then he began to experience, we've just read this song, Prabhupada says, one who has attained the perfection of chanting, as soon as that person chants Krishna's name, there is shivering in the body. And then he says, you know, this shouldn't be imitated, but Narottam is saying, when will that come? And after the shivering, while chanting Hare Krishna, there will be tears in the eyes. This is the natural effect of chanting. Well, very often I think it does happen. I'm sure some of you can testament to this. When first encountering the Maha Mantra, when it's somehow by destiny I receive that mantra, it's not uncommon for people to experience some ecstatic feeling. Usually it goes away, because the work has to be done. Yeah. It's just like that beautiful story of Narada when he was a child. Narada Muni, in his previous incarnation, he was orphaned at the age of 5, and so he went traveling. And one day he found himself beneath a tree beside a river, and he sat down to meditate, and amazing vision arose in his mind. He saw Narayan in his heart. Well, he saw him as if in his heart, but he saw that in the Bhagavatam, the description is there, his smile, his eyes, his lotus feet, the garland. And this young Narada, his eyes were streaming with tears, all the symptoms of ecstasy were in his body. And then suddenly the vision disappeared. And a voice told him, Lord Narayan said, I have shown you myself this once to increase your desire for me, but you will not see me again in this lifetime. We're speaking of Narada Muni, not just an ordinary person. He was able to see Vishnu once, and then the rest of his life he was simply thinking, when can I see that vision again? So it can work like that in, you know, spiritual life. We're given a taste, but then there may be some work to be done. Purification. It's just a question of time. It's just a question of time. If I'm thinking as Narottam is saying in the song, when will that time come? Just having that, you know, thought in my heart, not so much in my mind, but in my heart, that yearning, is a guarantee the time will come. And you know, what's a single lifetime in eternity is nothing. It seems a long time, you know, when you're living it, but as we all know, when you look back over the years, it doesn't seem so long compared to, you know, the profound experience of Krishna's association, however it comes. So it's a sort of promise, really, that, you know, if I have embarked upon this process, I will experience these things. And if I'm supposing I have experienced them and they seem to have gone, this wonderful feelings of connection with Krishna, this wonderful feeling of, you know, real sense of my own eternal connection with Krishna. If I felt it even a little bit, don't worry, it'll come back. But just some time has to pass, that's all. So after he had that experience in Gaya, actually the very night after chanting, Vishwambhara decided, he just felt uncontrollable desire. He had to go to Vrindavan and be with Krishna. That's all he could think of. And so he left in the middle of the night. He crept out, and his companions were asleep. And he just walked off into the forest. He's in Prayag. I don't know the distance. It's quite a few hundred miles, 400 or 500 miles perhaps from Vrindavan. And he was just set off to walk. And he was just calling on Krishna and walking in the night. And then suddenly, Vrindavan Das tells us, he must have told his friends because Vrindavan Das knew about him. He's on his own. But suddenly, a voice called to him out of the darkness. Vishwambhara, don't come now to Vrindavan. You have to go back to Navadvip. People will need you there. So when he heard that, he turned around and he went back and he told his student friends, okay, let's go. And they walked for a few weeks, all the way back to Navadvip. And on the way, we're told that at a certain village on the way, all the time, you know, Vishwambhara is in ecstasy and he's chanting. And suddenly he saw this beautiful cowherd boy. He ran after him. But the child disappeared. It's just mentioned that this happened. So, we know he saw Krishna, but he couldn't catch him. Anyway, they carried on, and he was pretty distraught after that. But he got back, his friends got him back to Navadvip, and when he arrived back, and everyone, you know, was looking forward to having him back, because he's such a fun guy to be around, you know? He was so popular. He was the star of the show in Navadvip. So he came back. But so when they met him when he got back to Navadvip, they couldn't recognize, you know, he completely changed. He didn't want to talk to anyone. He just said, excuse me, and he just went straight to his home. And gradually over the next few days, it became apparent, you know, that he had had this profound spiritual change of heart. It wasn't, you know, how are we to understand this? We know that, you know, from the beginning of his life, he was in love with Krishna, but it manifested in a different way. And the Vaishnavas who were in Navadvip, of course, they were beside themselves with ecstasy, because now they thought, you know, if we have Vishwambhara among us, we have nothing to fear. Because before that time they felt timid. They were oppressed by the Muslim rulers. And not just by the Muslim rulers, but oppressed also by the caste Brahmins, the dominant form of religion, of Hindu religion in Navadvip was Shakta, worship of Durga. So they felt themselves, you know, marginalized. But But when they knew that they had, and how did they know? Because what happened was every morning the Vaishnavas would meet down by the Ganges and bathe and chant and hear, you know. And suddenly Nimai turned up early in the morning, and he was looking after their clothes and serving them with great humility. They thought, this is not like Nimai. You know, he wasn't known for being humble. Quite the opposite, actually. He was known for being extremely arrogant. But, no, like I say, nobody could dislike him. And he became very humble. He was serving them, and they felt uncomfortable. Please don't serve us. We should be serving you, they said. And so he became their leader and, you know, very soon organized the Sankirtan movement. That's how the Sankirtan movement got moving. And as it grew, Lord Chaitanya, meanwhile, his first wife died, had already died, so he's remarried. He's married to Lakshmi Priya. His second wife was Vishnu Priya. You sure? So his second wife was Vishnu Priya. Okay. Thank you. So he's married and he's looking after his home, but he's become very, very absorbed in the Sankirtan movement. And people began to criticize him. Some envious voices, as happens, you know, when you start to express your religious experiences, your spiritual feelings, there are many, many people who can't understand what is going on. They can see that you're, you know, very happy, you're very expressive, and you seem to have a lot of energy, and there's lots of people are being attracted. So those who are not attracted, they don't like him. So when he saw that, he decided to become a sannyasi, and he renounced. And that's a sort of a tragic, it's not tragedy, but it was sort of tragic for his family and his close friends that he became a sannyasi and he left Navadvip. And when he became a sannyasi, immediately his thought was, now I'll go to Vrindavan. But his mother said, no, please, don't go so far away. Go somewhere nearby where I can see you. So he agreed to go to Jagannath Puri. But as soon as he got to Jagannath Puri, he said, and very quickly became the beloved of everyone there. They said, we now have two Jagannaths. In the temple we have the deity of Jagannath, and then we have the moving Jagannath. That's what they called him. But as soon as he sort of settled there, he said to his friends, he said, now please let me go to Vrindavan. So they were very reluctant to let him go, but eventually they agreed, and a whole party traveled with him to make sure of all his needs, you know. And by the time he reached, then he decided to go via Navadvip. So he would go up, he went north up the coast of Orissa to Bengal, visited Navadvip, and in Navadvip, the crowds were huge. Just to give some idea, he stayed in one house, and then the crowds were so great that he was advised you should go to another house, which meant crossing the Ganges. So he crossed the Ganges and went to another house, whereupon all the crowds crossed the Ganges, and there were so many of them, that and the boats were so overladen that there was danger of people drowning. There were tens of thousands of people crossing the Ganges following him, and the crowds just grew and grew and grew, and still he was determined to go to Vrindavan. So he set off, followed by these enormous crowds, and his fame was spreading in all directions. Word of mouth was going ahead, so people knew he was coming, and it was causing a huge commotion. And on his way, he went through the town where Rupa and Sanatan lived, who were the prime minister and the personal secretary of the king of Bengal, who was he was a very severe, he was an iconoclast. He destroyed many temples. He wasn't friendly to Hindus in general, but he knew that he had to keep the peace, so there had to be some limit. So it was causing a big commotion, and at night, Rupa and Sanatan secretly came to see him in the house where he was staying, and they said, we wanted to see you, we want to dedicate our lives to you, but we also want to advise you, don't travel in such a big crowd, it's dangerous. You'll attract, there'll be trouble. So when he heard that, and there was no way that he could have gone on his own because he's surrounded by all these people, he decided, okay, I'll have to abandon, this attempt to go to Vrindavan. And he turned around and he went back via Navadvip again, and he went back to Jagannath Puri. Then sometime later, he again tried to visit Vrindavan. This time, he travelled just with one companion, and he went through the jungle, kind of secretly. Anyway, he arrived in Prayag, and he was on his way to Vrindavan. And that's where Rupa Goswami somehow met him. And when they met, this famous verse was Rupa Goswami's greeting. Well, let's briefly just chant this verse together. Most of you know it. And we've got a beautiful translation here that Srila Prabhupada's given. So please chant after me. Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishna Krishna Chaitanya Namine Gore Tushe Namaha Namo Mahabhadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishna Krishna Chaitanya Namine Gore Tushe Namaha. So the translation Srila Prabhupada gives. O most munificent incarnation, you are Krishna himself, appearing as Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You have assumed the golden color of Srimati Radharani, and you are widely distributing pure love of Krishna. We offer our respectful obeisances unto you. So repeat the English. O most munificent incarnation, you are Krishna himself, appearing as Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You have assumed the golden color of Srimati Radharani, and you are widely distributing pure love of Krishna. We offer our respectful obeisances unto you. So this meeting with Rupa Goswami, let's see, I've got this here. This was such an important moment Oh, that's the wrong chapter. Excuse me. Because, you know, we are called, our tradition, we are called Rupanugas. Those who follow in the footsteps of Rupa. Rupa Goswami, he was a poet, and clearly he was just love personified. And he was blessed in this way by Lord Chaitanya. So after Rupa spoke these words, Mahaprabhu, Lord Chaitanya's, when he was initiated as a sannyasi, his sannyas guru, he had been called Vishwambhar, his sannyas guru gave him the name Krishna Chaitanya, because he said, you're always chanting the name of Krishna, and Chaitanya, you are the life of, you know, that is your life, chanting Krishna's name. But when he reached Puri, one of the first things that happened in Puri was the great master of Puri, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, became his disciple. So after that, people started calling him Mahaprabhu, which is more than just Prabhu, master, it's the great master. So he became known as Mahaprabhu. After Rupa came up to him and bowed at his feet, and he pronounced this beautiful verse, Mahaprabhu embraced Rupa and Anupam with great happiness, assuring them that Krishna had freed them forever from the prison of material life. Now he would enlighten Rupa with the secrets of Krishna consciousness. So you see, Rupa had to go on his own journey, and his brother Sanatan as well. It was not easy giving up their position in the material world, in society. There was a journey they had to go on. And part of that journey was here in Prayag. Lord Chaitanya blessed Rupa particularly, that he said, I will enlighten you now with the secrets of Krishna consciousness. It didn't end there. His discovery of Krishna consciousness continued, but this was a key moment. Some days passed before an opportunity rose. They arranged to meet just outside the town at Dasaswamedha Bathing Ghat. There, over a period of 10 days, Mahaprabhu taught Rupa about Krishna, about service to Krishna, and about the intricate secrets of loving relationships between Krishna and his devotees. And this wonderful teaching which was given to Rupa is in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, fills a whole chapter. And it went on for 10 days. For 10 days, Mahaprabhu expanded on so many topics, teaching Rupa everything about pure love for Krishna. Always think of Krishna, he concluded. Then Krishna will manifest in your heart and reveal everything to you. This is our process, that we, you know, we practice externally the principles of bhakti yoga. But all the time, you know, the focus of our aspiration is to meet Krishna in the heart. This is the mystical truth which Krishna speaks in the Bhagavad Gita. He says how, you know, I am everywhere, and yet I am also the very source of everything. Generally in this world, the divine is manifest in the various when Krishna needs to create this world, he doesn't personally come from Vrindavan. He manifests various incarnations who perform that. And so we have the three Vishnus especially. Mahavishnu, who gives rise to the multiple universes. Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, who enters into each universe and fills it with life. And Kiridakshaya Vishnu, who sits within the heart of every living being. So we have Vishnu in our heart. The mystery of Krishna consciousness is that Krishna himself will appear in the heart of his devotee. Prabhupada assured us of this. I was in his room here upstairs, and one day he said to us, Krishna is in your heart. I think he was probably, prior to that, he was probably talking about how do you recognize a guru, which he often said. He said, a guru says, surrender to Krishna. A guru doesn't say, surrender to me. Very simple, actually. Guru says, surrender to Krishna. Which is, I think, is the symptom of, that was Prabhupada's mood, is that followers of Srila Prabhupada are not known by his name. You know? Like they used to be the Rajneesh people, or the Guru Maharaji people, or the Maharishi people, or the this or that. Nobody calls us the Prabhupada people. Have you ever heard anyone call us that? They call us the Krishna people. So Prabhupada said that, you know, the guru, a genuine guru, says surrender to Krishna, which makes it so much easier for everyone. Because I may, and Prabhupada, anyway, I've heard things he said, but I won't repeat them because I didn't hear them myself. But he didn't want us to surrender to him, he wanted us to surrender to Krishna. So I think it was the same time, and he was saying that when you surrender to Krishna, Krishna will appear in your heart. You know, one who is a pure devotee of Krishna sees Krishna in the heart. He says, Krishna is not alone. He is there with Radharani, with all his associates from Vrindavan. The whole transcendental realm appears in your heart. And he said something most remarkable. He said, it's exactly like television. Just like television. And in this age, people are so addicted to television or screens of one sort or another. Living, you know, a virtual life through the screen, small or large. But this is the addiction. It's not an addiction. Addiction is a false thing. This is the experience that will dispel all other and all addictions, is to find that actually, amazingly, Krishna is in my heart. I'm speaking theoretically, but I believe it. That in course of time, by chanting Krishna's name and by serving, the two go together. That gift will be given to us to find Krishna in the heart. And when that happens, then all the time that has been spent, you know, wondering what happened to my ecstasy, where did it go, etc. You know, all the hard work and the disappointments and the ups and downs, which are part of the journey, will seem like a very small price to pay to have discovered that, you know, that inner connection which no one can take from me. And that is our birthright, that as soon as we take on the path of Krishna consciousness, it will certainly come. That's Lord Chaitanya's blessing upon all of us. So on this special day, we can all be very confident that it'll all come out right, you know, in the end. So, thank you very much. All glories to Lord Chaitanya. If Krishna's in the heart, why does he give us so many problems? Well, of course, the answer is we give ourselves problems. Krishna doesn't give us problems. Krishna only gives us blessings, even if they might appear problems sometimes. You know, they're not. I have a favorite story that always gives me encouragement. And it's an example of a great literary personality from the 20th century, Aldous Huxley, who wrote what a Brave New World, so many amazing books that Aldous Huxley wrote. Quite a spiritual guy, actually. Anyway, he was a student at Oxford University during the First World War. And when war broke out, it was amongst all his friends, you know, they felt it was their duty to volunteer to go to fight in the front line. So with great patriotic spirit, they all set off, joined up with the army, and they were sent on 3-month training. And so he was there with all his friends, and one day one of his friends made a stupid mistake and threw a hand grenade in the wrong direction, and it blew up next to Aldous Huxley and injured his foot. So much so that he, you know, he had to go to hospital, and for many months he was recovering in hospital. When finally came out of hospital, he was pronounced unfit to go and fight. So he thought, this is a terrible misfortune. And what a bizarre thing. A friend of mine blew my foot up, you know? Is there a God? So all his friends, nobly and patriotically, went off to the trenches, and every one of them was killed. And fortunately for us, Aldous Huxley, you know, survived to write dozens of amazing books. I'm talking from a literary point of view. And he also, by the way, he took initiation eventually from a guru in India, and he became a great follower of Vedanta. And the first translation I read of the Bhagavad Gita, which is what hooked me, was by Aldous Huxley. So thank you. Thank you, Aldous Huxley, for that. So, yeah, there's no God does not give us misfortune, but yes, it appears that way if I don't have that fundamental mood of gratitude. Whatever I am given in my life, whether it appears to be good fortune or bad fortune, let me embrace it and accept it as a blessing.